From the very beginning of its history, it is clear that Middle-earth is brimming with great spiritual powers. From the kingship of Manwë to the elvish love of Elbereth, Tolkien constructs a world where godlike figures seem to govern its affairs. Was Tolkien promoting a pagan religious outlook? Does his construction of Middle-earth betray his Catholic faith? Join us as we explore the relationship of Middle-earth and paganism. The Tolkien Road, Episode 222, Is Middle-earth Pagan? Hello everyone, welcome to the Tolkien Road episode 222, Is Middle-earth Pagan? Greta.
Hey, hey.
What's up?
What is up with you?
I asked you first.
Oh yeah, you did. I thought maybe you wouldn't notice.
Oh.
Let's see, what's up with me?
Can't get anything past
you know,
me.
It's true. You continually remind me of that. I think it's just the huge. I'm getting excited about Christmas.
Yeah.
Crazy to believe it's like less than a week away at this point.
Yeah, 6 days as of today as we record.
Yep. So. Countdown is on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how about you? What's up with you?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about Christmas. You know, I'm enjoying the kind of seasonal
weather.
Lull and the chilly weather. You know,
oh,
I do
I
like
you're gonna I say chilly weather.
Well, I do. I was going to say both. I do enjoy the you know me. You're a sunny day kind of person. I'm more more overcast, darker days in general.
Hmm.
Not all the time, but, you know, just a preference thing. If I have too many sunny days, I'm like, you know, I need a little more mood.
That, in a nutshell, is all you need to know about the difference in our personality.
This is true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we balance each other well.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I like a cloudy day now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the clouds affect me more than they affect you.
Well, same with me. I mean, I enjoy a nice sunny day, especially in warmer weather. I mean, I really like the sunny days, but I do need my the rainy days. You know, the rainy overcast kind of days put me in a more creative mood. You know, ironically, sunny days just kind of feel like days I want to get out and enjoy the weather.
Yeah,
you know?
I can see that.
So when
I
I'm working on a sunny day, it's kind of like, oh, this is a bummer. You know.
Yeah, I understand that. If it weren't for rainy days, I don't think I'd ever do laundry.
Yeah.
Because there's something about rainy days and laundry that just go together
for me.
So
thank God for rainy days. Thank God for rainy days.
It's true.
From the entire Carswell household.
Yes.
On this episode, we are going to take a look at another question pertaining to Lord of the Rings and religion. Specifically, does Lord of the Rings promote a pagan view of reality?
Wow.
So
sounds interesting.
That's what we got in store. This is a really interesting topic. So.
Cool.
But before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien and Lise Yu.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you both so much for your awesome patronage, executive production patronage. And we want to give a shout out to our newest patron, Anne Marie S. Thank you, Anne Marie, for your pledge of support.
We appreciate you.
And you too can support us on Patreon if you do not already. Or if you have in the past and you stopped and you want to do it again, you can support us on Patreon. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like early access to new episodes and more. Head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road to find out the deets. And then if you're a give one time, give a tip kind of person, right? You can go to a specific episodes page and find the tip jar and leave us a tip right there on that episode. So if you're particularly moved by something, you know, just drop us that $1 million tip you want to give us.
Yeah.
So
we won't say no.
And if you drop us $1 million tip, I promise you, we won't ever ask you for money again.
Yeah. And you'll be an executive producer for life.
Yeah, oh, definitely. you'd be like the Uber executive producer. So
you'd be the executive producer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So finally, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Please leave us a 5-star rating and say some nice things about us. Leaving 5 stars and a review helps get the word out about the Tolkien Road. So please, if nothing else, head on over and leave us that 5 stars and tell the world what you love about the Tolkien Road. So Not much in the way of news, but I do want to say that we have a poll up. So I put a poll up over on our Patreon page. We're looking for your feedback on what major work we should focus on for 2021. So, and this is open to everybody, not just patrons, but to every, you know, to everybody. Now, I will say, you know, I mean, we're probably going to wait a little more towards what the patrons have to say, right? So, but we want to hear from everybody, right? We want to hear from everybody, you know, so head on over there. You can just go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/TolkienRoad, and you'll find it. It should be one of the top posts there. Or you can just go to TolkienRoad.com/poll21, and that'll forward you to the Patreon poll automatically. So again, that's TolkienRoad.com/poll21, P-O-L-L 21.
Now, do you have options listed there, or are people just writing in what they want?
I do have options listed there. Yeah, okay. Good question. So okay. People can write, you know, they can leave comments and say whatever they want to. It's basically the ones I gave are doing a Lord of the Rings reread, The Children of Húrin, which we have not read on this podcast yet, doing a Silmarillion reread, doing The Fall of Gondolin, which we also have not done, or doing the Beren and Lúthien book, the full book version of Beren and Lúthien.
Okay.
Which is not really like exactly a not, it's, so The Children of Húrin is probably the one I'm most interested to do because it's actually a full book length treatment of that story.
Okay.
Whereas Fall of Gondolin and Beren and Lúthien are more like kind of the histories of those stories, right? The development and the histories of those stories. So, but anyway, you can go on over there, and then there's a sixth option to say something else, and you specify in the comments. So this is not meant to be like, this is the only thing we're going to talk about next year, but it's meant to say like, what major work should we kind of build next year's run of episodes around? So
cool.
Yeah.
I'm excited. How long is it going to be up for?
Indefinitely right now, not forever, but you know, I'll probably leave it up at least for the next week or two. So whenever you're hearing this, do head on over and let us know what you think.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. So that's again, TolkienRoad.com/poll21, P-O-L-L 21. All right. So Tolkien quote of the week. So this is a good one from On Fairy Stories. Art has been verified. God is the Lord of angels and of men and of elves. Legend and history have met and fused. That's from the epilogue for On Fairy Stories, which is you know, one of my favorite nonfiction things that Tolkien wrote. In that particular passage, you know, the epilogue from that is particularly moving to me. And I thought this was a great one just because it's kind of topical for, you know, what we're going to be speaking about on this week's episode. God is the Lord of angels and of men and of elves, right? Mm-hmm. Legend and history have met and fused. And that's, to me, that's what Tolkien is all about, right? That's kind of one of Tolkien's key insights about just his view of the world with his, you know, with his Middle Earth legendarium and everything else he wrote. So, I love this. Art has been verified that the things that we do, you know, the things that we make, the things that we're inclined to create, those aren't just like random things, that those, you know, that Tolkien believed that those things come to us from some outside source.
Mm-hmm.
And,
they're inspired
and they're part of our destiny.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm. That is beautiful.
And there's something else that it's kind of a hint. We can only do so much with it,
mm-hmm.
but it's, you know, but in the end it's going to be, you know, pan out into something complete and wonderful beyond our imagining. Mm-hmm. So
for sure. Wow. I love that.
Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. All right, Greta, you ready to talk about Middle Earth and paganism?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So a few weeks ago, we did an episode on Lord of the Rings and religion. In that episode, number 218, we spoke about the role that religion, and in particular Tolkien's Catholic faith, played in the creation of Middle Earth. The short answer, it played a major role, but not necessarily a defining one. For more info on that, go back and listen to episode 218. You know, we talked about a lot there. I also want to say from the outset, after I compiled all of my notes for this particular episode, I decided we're going to push our feedback from Lord of the Rings and religion to episode 223. So we're going to, because we got a good bit of it and I want to give it due time. And so for all of those who have written in and written responses, I know we'd kind of hinted that this was probably going to be the time we got to that, but it's going to be next week. So it, you know, it just kind of makes sense so we can spend enough time on this topic.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I only have so much time we can really devote to doing the podcast at any one time too. So
true that.
So I think that'll work out well.
Well, now I have something else to look forward to besides Christmas.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. So anyone who pays close attention to Lord of the Rings, and especially those who get into the Silmarillion, will notice the overwhelming fact that Middle-earth is a place dominated by a multitude of spiritual forces. Historically, we might call this a pagan view of things. Thus, this begs the question, is Middle-earth pagan? Do Tolkien's Middle-earth works promote a pagan view of reality? Some Christians are critical of Lord of the Rings and Middle-earth because they believe they promote a pagan view of reality and even polytheistic worship. This is problematic for Christians because Christianity has always taught monotheistic worship, that it is only proper for human beings to worship God as revealed in the person of Jesus Christ. Furthermore, Tolkien himself claimed to be a Christian, so this is particularly problematic because of the wolf in sheep's clothing effect. Tolkien may be leading fellow Christians astray into a pagan worldview and even polytheistic worship. At least that's the claim of these Christians. So you can probably know right off the bat that that's not my view, but I'm trying to give the best interpretation of the view of some fellow Christians of why they might look suspiciously or even negatively on Tolkien's works for a theological reason. And I'm going to talk about those reasons, and then I'm going to talk about why I think that's wrong. So I should even note that I've caught wind of some self-professed pagans embracing Tolkien's works for this reason, or at least trying to claim Tolkien as one of their own. So it's not just that Christians look at Tolkien's work. Some Christians look at Tolkien's works and say, well, he's promoting paganism or polytheism. It's that, and therefore we shouldn't read them. But actually, there are some, paganism is kind of has been making a comeback for the last generation in some circles. And there are pagans I've run across who would claim Tolkien's works for their own, right? For kind of this reason, saying that he had a view that was supportive of their view of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially through his Middle Earth works. So, and I also think that's mistaken. So I'm going to, you know, really speak to both of those things and try to address both parties in this episode. And this will probably not be exhaustive. There's so much to say on this topic, and it's really a truly fascinating one to me that I had to kind of cut myself short to, you know, to be able to get it in to one episode and address this. So I'm guessing this will be something we come back to in the future, because mm-hmm. this is a topic that I'm particularly interested in when it comes to Tolkien. And I kind of have, this is all kind of part of the next book I want to eventually write on Tolkienian things.
Okay.
So
cool.
So my goal, I should say this is a huge topic. I expect we will continue on this topic. And it's truly fascinating. First, we need to define some terms. So I'm going for really kind of simple definitions here. First off, what do we mean by pagan? All right, that's a term. That's actually a funny term. You know, the first time I heard the term pagan was like as a little kid, and there was a movie. Do you remember the old TV show Dragnet?
I never watched it, but I know of it.
So, you know, it was kind of a classic like police TV show. Mm-hmm. And then there was a movie version of it made in the 80s that I saw in theaters probably when I was like a little kid, because you know, Greta, I sometimes saw movies that maybe like most little kids didn't go and see. My parents were just a little more free will, and I was the third child, so
yeah,
I think they were a little more free
will. Yeah, older siblings, so yeah.
So but anyway, and it's not like it's like some like horrible movie or anything like that, but you know, it's probably not a movie that like young kids should necessarily be seeing. Anyway, I digress. In that movie, there's actually it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek movie. It's not mm-hmm. exactly like a spoof, but it's like it is kind of funny. And they I remember they have the basically like the bad guys in that movie are part of are call themselves pagans, but it's not like what people who are religiously pagan actually mean by pagan. It's kind of like this like quasi satanic, you know, cult and everything.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. I think we were talking about this the other night at dinner too, because I don't know how it came up, but we got to talking about the, like, what does the word pagan actually mean? And I feel like the most people, myself included for a while, thought it basically meant those who absolutely had no religion. Like it wasn't It was like a, it was the opposite of religion, right? Like they, it was almost like an atheist, right? Like where they believed that there was, no, not atheist, whatever. Anyway, it was something that was completely void. A pagan was someone that was completely void of worship or religion, but that's not the case.
Right. You know, so, so that's interesting because there's another view, right, of it. And so I think that pagan often in the hands of Christians historically, I think especially in the time periods when Christianity was very ascendant, right, when it was kind of at the top of the heap, would have like used pagan in a very like pejorative, even negative sense of being like, you know, this is a person who has the wrong belief, whatever it is.
Right.
And certainly doesn't believe in the Christian religion. So, I want to be very, as fair as I can with this. And so, and if there's people who are of this, you know, particular religious view who take issue with my definitions, then please let me know where I go wrong. But what I kind of the simple definitions I found were pagan, a polytheistic religion, or pagan, one who worships nature, right? And this is like what it meant in the original context of when Christianity came along, right? Paganism was generally thought of as like the view that different nations kind of had their own, different groups of people kind of had their own gods, right? That they worshiped and gods, right? A group of deities, you know, that usually were kind of tied to their experience of nature and that they would form a religious cult around, a religious practice around, right? So, you know, you think of like the mythologies, right? You think of Greek and Roman mythology, which are the two mythologies that we'd be most familiar with, especially in the West. And, you know, they had their different kind of temples to different gods. And, you know, you can think of like, you know, Apollo and, I'm really bad with naming them, but you know,
Zeus,
Apollo. And then
are we doing Greek or Roman?
It doesn't really matter. Apollo would be like a Greek, you know, Greek god.
Right.
Zeus would be a Roman god. Zeus is Greek too. Jupiter would be, I think the Roman version of Zeus.
I think that's right.
So
paganism is actually not the absence of religion. It's just its own form of religion that involves more than one god.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So paganism is a view that there are multiple gods that kind of rule over creation, or maybe rule over a particular place, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a vast topic, right?
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And it's a vast group of beliefs, and one group of pagans might not agree with another group of pagans. I'm sure there's like kind of an, I think there's kind of like a neo-pagan view of the world too, where it's, you know, kind of tries to harmonize a lot of the ancient pagan the religions that had very disparate cults. But anyway, it's a pretty it encompasses many different things.
Okay.
So again, just shorthand definitions, pagan would be either a polytheistic religion or one who worships nature, right?
Okay.
So is Middle Earth a place where polytheism is promoted? Is polytheism okay? And did Tolkien himself ever address these charges? Furthermore, what does Tolkien's own particular brand of Christianity have to say about all of this? So, proceeding from there, first, let's set aside the question of religious cult and look at the nature of Middle Earth's reality. Does Middle Earth proclaim a polytheistic view of reality? What would you say off the top of your head?
Well, it's interesting. I think the word that's tripping me up is the word, like the words promote and proclaim.
Yeah.
Because I would say that there's definitely polytheism represented in Middle Earth.
Okay.
But is it promoted or proclaimed? I'm not so sure.
Okay.
Because I feel like I would have to say no to that question. Because I feel like the polytheistic, you know, things don't really go very well for those groups of people that choose a polytheistic way of worship.
Okay. Well, and that's why initially we're setting aside the question of worship, of religious cult. That's what I mean by that. Right. So it's not so much a question of, we're going to look at this in just a moment, but we're going to start off not by looking so much at like, do people worship many gods or should they worship many gods, but just simply, are there many gods?
Right? And to that question, yes, I think there are.
Why would you say that?
Well, Because
not a trick question, by the way.
I was going to say because of the Valar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So, and here's the thing: Tolkien actually had several things to say about this question, especially in his letters. So you know, and because the Valar are, although they're not like as majorly present in Lord of the Rings as they are in the Silmarillion, for example. They are there, right? You know, there Elbereth is mentioned as well as other other Valar. Mm-hmm. So what did Tolkien have to say about this in regard to the question of are they gods or not? So one of the first references I found was in letter 153, which was a draft to Peter Hastings written in September of 1954. This may be the same letter where he talks about Lord of the Rings being fundamentally religious and Catholic, but that may be another letter as well. But here's what he had to say. And this is Tolkien again. As for whose authority decides these things, the immediate authorities are the Valar, the powers or authorities, the gods. And he has gods in quote in a mm-hmm. quotation marks. But they are only created spirits of high angelic order, we should say. But their attendant lesser angels. Reverend, therefore, but not worshipful, and though potently subcreative and resident on earth to which they are bound by love, having assisted in its making and ordering, they cannot by their own will alter any fundamental provision. They called upon the one, i.e. Eru Ilúvatar, in the crisis of the rebellion of Numenor, when the Numenoreans attempted to take the undying land by force of a great armada and their lust for corporal immortality, which necessitated a catastrophic change in the shape of the earth. So, so we see here that Tolkien makes a distinction, right? So he does refer to them as gods initially, but he makes a distinction that they are created spirits, right? They're of a high angelic order, right? So this is where he introduces that concept of, you know, of being angels, right? Mm-hmm. The Valar are maybe more properly thought of as angels in Tolkien's view, okay. Right? He says, reverend, therefore, but not worshipful. Okay. Now, that distinction is going to come back later when we talk about Tolkien's own views of these things, because as a Catholic, his views of worship were somewhat more nuanced than maybe what a Protestant Christian's view mm-hmm. of worship is. Right. Yeah. So, and that's something we both know personally because we both grew up Protestant. And have become Catholic, right, yes. In our adult lives. So.
Yes, and that difference between, so when he says reverend, therefore, but not worshipful, that can basically be translated to say they are beings that are owed reverence,
right,
but not worship.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a really tricky distinction.
It is.
For a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
for myself included.
And that's kind of, we're going to get into that also later in this episode is, you know, what were Tolkien's views of those concepts, mm-hmm. right? What did he mean by that distinction?
Right.
He also says they're potentially subcreative. And I think it's easy to gloss this over, but it's important, right? They are potently subcreative. Now, what does that word subcreative mean? That has to do with subcreation, which is Tolkien's idea that, that God alone, right, Eru Ilúvatar in Middle-earth, creates everything from nothing, and then the rest of us, or at least the rest of, like, kind of sentient, mm-hmm. intelligent creatures, do the work of subcreation, which is taking the creation as he's provided it to us and transforming it into something that is destined for it, right? That,
yes.
That's kind of destined for it. So we participate in his creative action.
But we don't right? create things out of nothing the way he did.
Right. And again, this is an important distinction because it shows that as powerful as these gods, these Valar might be, right? They aren't infinitely powerful, right?
Right.
They don't have complete dominion and they are subordinate at all times. And I would say even infinitely subordinate to Eru Ilúvatar.
And are they right. also created beings?
Yes.
They
right.
are.
Yeah. It says they are only created spirits.
Created
right?
spirits. Got it.
Yeah. So, and he points out that in the crisis of the rebellion of Numenor, they had to call upon Eru Ilúvatar, right, to intervene, mm-hmm. right? Because, mm-hmm. And you can learn more about that in Akalabeth, but when Numenor rebelled and tried to enter the Undying Lands, the Valar had to basically ask Ilúvatar to help because the Numenoreans had become so powerful. Mm-hmm. So, So that's kind of a first indication of what Tolkien's view of, you know, of the nature of this reality were. The Valar are not properly considered gods per se, but rather what in Christian theology and Jewish theology you'd call angels, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Next, the Valar and the Blessed Trinity. So Tolkien actually gets a little more explicit with his Christian view of God. Here in a letter 131 to Milton Waldman, my favorite letter, the Waldman letter, mm-hmm. from September of 1950. He says, "The cycles begin with a cosmogonical myth, the music of the Ainur. God and the Valar, or powers, Englished as gods, are revealed. These latter are, as we should say, angelic powers, whose function is to exercise delegated authority in their spheres of rule and government, not creation, making or remaking. They are divine, that is, were originally outside and existed before the making of the world. Their power and wisdom is derived from their knowledge of the cosmogonical drama, which they perceived first as a drama, that is, as in a fashion we perceive a story composed by someone else, and later as a reality. On the side of mere narrative device, this is, of course, meant to provide beings of the same order of beauty, power, and majesty as the gods of higher mythology, which can yet be accepted, well, shall we say baldly, by a mind that believes in the Blessed Trinity." So this is really interesting, because what he basically says there at the end of that quote is the Valar are supposed to be these sorts of lowercase g gods that would be harmonious to a mind that believes in the Blessed Trinity, right?
Hmm.
In the sense that, again, the Blessed Trinity being the one who is distinct from these others, and that the Blessed Trinity can create from nothing,
right?
Can create from pure nothingness, okay? And these lowercase g gods are not, right? Cannot do that. All right. And they only have their role is to rule and govern, right? Not to make from nothing.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So, but I really liked that quote, because he comes right out and says, like, I don't mean for these to conflict with, you know, in the mind for the conception of these Valar, these beings, to conflict theologically with in the mind of a person who believes in the Blessed Trinity,
right?
So in other words, a kind of traditional Christian, right?
Yes.
So anyway, I think that's a good one to make too, because Tolkien right there says, like, you know, this is not meant to be a I'm not trying to promote a pagan in other words, I'm not trying to promote a pagan non-Christian view of reality,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I intend these gods, to me, these gods fit into a Christian view of reality.
Right. And he's always very careful to write gods in quotes.
Right.
Yeah. Which I think
exactly.
is interesting.
Last on this particular topic is, so just this quick note that the Valar and Melkor are greatly inferior to Iluvatar. So, and this is also from the Waldman letter. He says, "The knowledge of the creation drama was incomplete. Incomplete in each individual god, lowercase g, and incomplete if all the knowledge of the pantheon was pooled. For, partly to redress the evil of the rebel Melkor, partly for the completion of all in an ultimate finesse of detail, the creator had not revealed all."
Hmm.
Right? So, not only are the gods not all-powerful, meaning the Valar, right, but they are not all-knowing either, right? They can't see the entirety of the future.
Right.
And one might even argue they don't know everything going on in Middle Earth all the time, right?
Yeah.
They have some greater ability to know these things, but they don't necessarily know everything, right?
Right.
In the way that a Eru Iluvatar would, mm-hmm. being omniscient, all-powerful,
mm-hmm.
Omniscient, and all-powerful in Middle Earth, that he would have that ability.
Right.
So
they're still dependent on Eru, mm-hmm. to reveal things to them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
So it's kind of like, if you want to, if I may be so bold as to bring a little bit of Catholicism into this,
mm-hmm.
we could maybe, I feel like the Valar,
mm-hmm.
would be comparable to, you know, maybe the archangels.
Okay. Yeah.
And obviously Eru on the level of God.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. Good thought.
Fair enough.
So it is clear that behind Middle-earth, only one divine being exists, Eru Iluvatar. This is, of course, borne out in Ainu Lindale itself, right? So really, in the end, all you have to do is look at Ainu Lindale, the creation story, to understand that, yeah, the Valar are infinitely subordinate to Eru Iluvatar. That doesn't mean they're not powerful, but infinitely subordinate means that Eru Iluvatar is infinite, right? All of these things and all of his, what traditionally theology calls his perfections, he is infinite, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are not. As powerful as they may be, they are finite, right? They're created and contingent. All right. So even with all that said, is it okay to worship the Valar and the Maiar? Are there existing religious cults to these figures? And so we got some other helpful quotes here. All right. And this is where it gets really interesting, because he does talk about the nature of religion in Middle Earth, right? Actually in the reality of Middle Earth. So the first quote I have concerns the elves and religion. This is from a draft letter 156, which is drafted to Robert Murray, who is, of course, a Jesuit, so would have been a well-versed Catholic. And to Robert Murray, he says, "The high elves were exiles from the blessed realm of the gods after their own particular elvish fall, and they had no religion or religious practices, rather, for those had been in the hands of the gods, praising and adoring Eru, the One, Iluvatar, the father of all, on the Mount of Aman." Right? So, the elves had no religion, right? Now, this one might be a little surprising to some people, because there is that classic scene in Lord of the Rings where Frodo and Sam stumble upon the elves, and they're actually singing a hymn to Elbereth, right? To Varda, to the Lady of the
Stars.
That's
right, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we might find ourselves kind of struggling to reconcile those two things. What I'll say about that right now, and I don't have a quote directly from Tolkien to support this. There may be one for all I know, but I don't think once you understand in just a minute, the Catholic view of worship versus reverence or veneration, I think that will make more sense, right? How this quote that I just read, and then the elves' apparent worship of Elbereth, reconcile.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. But we can kind of look at this own. We can kind of parse this particular quote to understand it as well. Okay. So the elves had no religion per se, right? They had no like particular religious cult where they all come together like we typically think of. Nowadays we call it organized religion, right? Because everybody's like, well, I got to distinguish between organized religion, because I'm in favor of organized religion, but I'm spiritual but not religious, right? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of it's a cliche now, but we know what people mean when they say that, right? They're saying like, well, you know, I don't really belong or subscribe to any particular creed or cult. I'm just feeling spiritual, man.
Yeah.
Just feeling spiritual.
Yeah.
So the elves were kind of, they just felt spiritual.
Yeah.
You know?
I can see that.
They just felt spiritual, and but they left the religion to the Valar. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Right.
It's very
interesting. That in Tolkien's view, the Valar in this time were the ones with religion.
Yeah.
They were the ones, and who was their religion devoted to? Eru Iluvatar.
Right.
Yeah. To the one God.
Yeah.
So the only religion that kind of officially existed in the first age, at least, or even before the first age, was monotheistic. Right?
Right.
It was completely devoted
exactly
to Eru Iluvatar.
Yeah.
And it was the worship of the gods, the lowercase g gods of Eru Iluvatar.
Huh.
All right. The next question that I want to look at on the subject of worship is with the Numenorians religion. So the Numenorians were monotheists, all right? And those of you who have listened to our episodes on the Second Age, you've probably figured this out by now. Here's the quote. This is from the letter to Robert Murray, the draft one, letter 156. "The Numenorians thus began a great new good and as monotheists, but like the Jews, only more so, with only one physical center of worship, the summit of the Mount Meneltarma, Pillar of Heaven. Literally, for they did not conceive of the sky as a divine residence, in the center of Numenor. But it had no building and no temple, as all such things had evil associations." All right? So again, you know, the Numenoreans were the really the first of the children of Iluvatar to have something like an organized religion, right? Yeah. And it was all centered around the Pillar of Heaven, the mountain that's in the middle of Numenor, okay? And it's interesting to me, the relation he makes between the Numenoreans and the Jews right here, right? The comparison. Because the Numenoreans in Tolkien's mythology are kind of like a chosen people before before the Jews, right? And so the Numenoreans are given a religion, and it's kind of almost like part of their privilege of having this island set apart that they get to worship Eru Iluvatar, right? Now, it's not necessarily like, if you read, like, it's not a super involved religious cult per se. If you read more about Numenor, like, it basically had three times they went up on the mountain every year, and they just kind of went up there, did a few things, and came back down. Now, I'm hoping we find out more maybe about this when we get the new book on the nature of Middle Earth, more of what Tolkien might have had in mind for the Numenorean religion. And, you know, I hope this is fleshed out in the upcoming Lord of the Rings on Prime series, which is going to deal so much with Numenor. But all that is to say, they were basically given something like a mirror image of the Valar religion, right? The Valar religion to worship Iluvatar.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the last quote I have on this particular topic of worship is, and worship in Middle Earth, is from letter 153, again, from that letter to Peter Hastings. So this is a little bit longer. There are thus no temples or churches or fanes in this world among good peoples. They had little or no religion in the sense of worship. For help, they may call on a Vala, as Elbereth, as a Catholic might on a saint, though no doubt knowing in theory as well as he that the power of the Vala was limited and derivative. But this is a primitive age, and these folk may be said to view the Valar as children view their parents or immediate adult supervisors. And though they know they are subjects of the king, he does not live in their country nor have there any dwelling. I do not think hobbits practiced any form of worship or prayer, unless through exceptional contact with elves. The Numenoreans and others of that branch of humanity that fought against Morgoth, even if they elected to remain in Middle-earth and did not go to Numenor, such as the Rohirrim, were pure monotheists. But there was no temple in Numenor until Sauron introduced the cult of Morgoth. The top of the mountain, the Minotaurma or Pillar of Heaven, was dedicated to Eru, the One, and there, at any time privately and at certain times publicly, God was invoked, praised, and adored. An imitation of the Valar and the Mountain of Aman. But Numenor fell and was destroyed, and the mountain engulfed, and there was no substitute. Among the exiles, remnants of the faithful who had not adopted the false religion nor taken part in the rebellion, religion as divine worship, though perhaps not as philosophy and metaphysics, seems to have played a small part. Though a glimpse of it is caught in Faramir's remark on grace at meat in Lord of the Rings. So, a lot in there. But again, you know, I think what we can really take away from it is that in Tolkien's own view of his own work, of his own world that he created, there really is only, in terms of a formal religion, monotheism. And even that's a kind of limited to just certain particular groups of people, right? And I think this all makes sense because in Tolkien's view, he's writing a pre-Christian mythology,
right?
He intends for his world to be a world that pre-exists our own world. Within our own world is a history, like a mythological history of our own world, that predates the incarnation of Christ, right? The coming of Christ, the coming of God in the flesh, right? When he takes on human flesh. And so there's the same sense of progressive revelation, right, going on in the world of Middle Earth as there is in a Christian view of history, right?
Yeah.
The sense that God doesn't tell everything about his plan up front, right? God doesn't reveal everything about himself up front, right?
Right.
From the very beginning. He slowly kind of introduces new things, right? Leading up to the grand climax, which, you know, Tolkien called the catastrophe of history, of the incarnation, right? When Christ, when the second person of the Trinity became man.
So you're saying that in Tolkien's view, this progression of revelation mirrors that of, like, even though it was pre-Christian, it mirrors the the progression of revelation that we have in the Bible.
Exactly, right? And mirror may be the wrong term, but it's supposed to at least be consonant with it, right?
Okay, like imitate or...
Yeah, be harmonious with it, right?
Okay.
It's important, I think, for him to be able to say, you know, it's like the date of March 25th, which we've covered in, we've covered in other episodes.
Mm-hmm.
He chose that date, not just as a wink, but because like that date is so important in the history of Christianity, right? Because, he intends that date to be significant as the day that the ring was destroyed. It's almost like the earliest, great moment of redemption,
right,
in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it points forward, it hints at the greater dates of, that date would be significant in the future. It's kind of the date of the Annunciation and potentially the date of the crucifixion as well.
Right. Yeah. It's really interesting to me that the first appearance or the mention of a temple in Middle Earth, which was in Numenor, was associated with evil.
Isn't it?
It's really interesting. Because I feel like that could possibly, because when you think about, temples, it's definitely, at least when I think of temples, its direction is toward organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say? Because it's a gathering place. Right, it's an actual physical place that people go, and it's set apart for a particular purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before that, they just went to the top of a mountain.
Yeah.
Right. It's the same reason that beautiful cathedrals. I find it easier to worship in beautiful cathedrals because you really do feel like you're being transported. But before that, they didn't have those in Middle Earth. They would just go to a mountain.
Right.
And so it's hard for me to think, I feel like it'd be much harder for me to worship on a mountain than it would be in a temple. I don't even know where I'm going with this.
You know what? It's a fantastic observation. Yeah. It really is. It is very interesting to me as well that Numenor being this like kind of the first of the children of Iluvatar to have a religion per se, even like a divinely revealed religion per se, that they didn't worship in a temple made by human hands, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they didn't, that actually it was Sauron who introduced the worship of, worshiping in temples, and it was for evil purpose.
Right.
Right. It was actually for, to worship Morgoth.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a way to view that. And I don't know that I necessarily want to get too much into it on this episode, but I think there's a way to view that's also consonant with the Christian view of, the Christian view of itself, right? If you think about just the Old Testament itself, right? Well, how does the history of redemption within the Old Testament proceed, right? Well, you do have sacrifice and that kind of thing, like early in the book of Genesis, for example, but Abraham doesn't have a, temple that
no.
God doesn't tell him to create a temple. He tells
him
to go up on a mountain.
Sure, he does.
and sacrifice, right?
Yeah.
And that's what you get all the way up to the time of Moses, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's that kind of system, you're not building temples and this kind of thing, but you don't get anything until Moses comes along, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Mosaic system, right?
That's true.
And it's with that that you get the actual, it culminates in the temple in Jerusalem, right? After several generations, it begins with the tabernacle, which they use wandering through the desert, which is kind of a mobile temple.
Mobile temple, yep.
And then it arrives at the temple, in Jerusalem eventually. So, you see that progression of like, they have to go within the temple, but then in the Christian view, when Christ comes along, right? He kind of, what happens, right? When he dies, the veil of the temple is torn in two.
Torn in two.
Right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the temple no longer has the, I want to be careful here, because this is a very nuanced kind of conversation, but in the Christian view, it's kind of like the temple no longer has the place it once did because Christ is the temple. right? Mm-hmm. Christ is the temple. So what does that mean for churches and cathedrals? I love my beautiful churches. I love my beautiful cathedrals, all these sorts of things. I love the beautiful religious buildings of other religions that I don't believe in. Mm-hmm. But I think kind of the movement of history is back towards, you know, that worship outside of the temple. Right. And I'm talking in an eschatological sense, not in the sense of the here and now.
Yeah.
Obviously, with our Christian faith, we're okay. You know, we certainly believe in using churches and temples. And but it also begs the question of, like, how necessary are those things really? Like, necessary in a strict sense.
Right.
Right. For the actual worship, for the proper worship of God. Right.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right about that.
So, because, I mean, the first Christians didn't have big cathedrals and beautiful churches to worship in. Right. They had to meet in people's homes, right?
That's true. And they met underground and in the catacombs.
And those sorts of places.
Yeah, that's true.
I think the actual, the very first Christians, the Jewish Christians they actually went to the temple. Like, I think they actually would go to the temple, if memory serves, you know, to at least close to the temple for their, you know, for whatever religious rites they conducted. But the temple wasn't necessarily, like, key to it all. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened to be the place they normally gathered as Jews. So why wouldn't they gather there if they believe that their Messiah is the fulfillment of the Jewish religion? So,
right.
All that is to say, you had a really great inclination there. A really great, great question.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, the trajectory is that, because where in Christian theology, where is the ultimate temple that God wants? What is the ultimate temple that God wants?
The ultimate temple that God wants?
Yeah.
It's us.
Exactly.
It's us.
Right. It's our hearts.
Right. And that's what makes it interesting, because when you were saying that Moses worshipped on the mountaintop, and then, you know, the early Christians, you know,
worshipped on the mountaintop.
I'm sorry. Abraham worshipped on the mountaintop. And then early Christians were under, you know, had to worship in the catacombs. And so that really begs the question, well, then, if anywhere, you know, if you can worship anywhere, what is it that sets that place apart for worship?
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be the presence of God.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what really sets it apart.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, you know, if the earliest worship in Middle Earth happened on top of a mountain, as long as Eru was there, I mean, that was their temple.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and especially if that's where he told them to worship.
Right. Exactly.
If that was where it was told them that they needed to worship at the Valar, when they were, hey, we're making this place called Numenor for you. You're going to go there and you're going to live. It's going to be your reward.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to worship Iluvatar, and this is how you do it.
Yep.
Right.
Boom.
You know, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And, you know, and even when it comes to our Catholic, you know, our Catholic views and Tolkien's Catholic views, a building is not strictly needed for the supreme worship of God.
No,
right?
No, you're absolutely right.
The supreme act of worship in Catholic theology, you'll normally find it there, right? Mm-hmm. And there are certainly many places dedicated to that, but to that purpose. But you can have Mass outside, mm-hmm. right?
You can. And you can have Mass in your house.
Right.
And as long as the body of Christ is there,
mm-hmm.
it's Mass.
Well, and you can have Mass as long as you have a
priest.
Right,
as long as you have a priest, exactly. Well,
so,
yeah. I oversimplified, but yeah, I mean that, but then that goes back to, that's what, like, what is it that makes that place suitable for worship? It's just that God is present.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So that leads us, you know, so the last kind of topic we're going to look at here is the distinction, some distinctions when it comes to the Catholic view of worship. Again, this is important because Tolkien, as a Catholic, would have had a particular view of worship and veneration and when it's proper and who it's proper to and these sorts of questions. That's a little more nuanced than at least what I knew when I was a non-Catholic Christian,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have a different view of these things as Catholics. And I will say that from what I understand, I want to say that our Orthodox brothers and sisters also have a very similar view of these things. Now, I won't speak to say that it's exactly the same, but from what I understand, it's pretty similar. And it's important. Let me say this too: it's important that that these things are consonant with Tolkien's religious views, I think it's important for him, because he said in letter 269, while I don't feel under any obligation to make my story fit with formalized Christian theology, I actually intended it to be consonant with Christian thought and belief. So he did intend for all these things to be consonant with Christian thought and belief, right?
Yes.
To go along, to be harmonious with. Consonant is another word for harmonious,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what does Catholicism have to say about all, you know, these kinds of questions? What kind of worship and veneration is appropriate, and in what contexts are they appropriate, and to whom should they be directed? So we really have to define what we mean by the term worship in all of this. Catholic teaching promotes an important distinction here. Worship, or latria, which is due to God alone, and that primarily means the Mass, the supreme act of worship that is only ever offered to God, right? So when we talk about worship or latria or adoration in a very kind of strict sense, we're talking about the Mass, the holy sacrifice of the Mass,
right? Yep.
That this is the supreme act of worship that God has revealed and said, this is what I want, right? This is what I ask of you, mm-hmm. right? This is something that, like, I continue to learn so much more about as a Catholic, and it just keeps exploding my mind of, like, what the significance of this is, right? But we also have to mention that there's something called veneration, or dulia, D-U-L-I-A, which can be given to creatures, especially if they are particularly worthy for some moral reason. So Catholicism allows for this. Catholicism allows for veneration, dulia, and actually in the case of Mary, there's a particular term called hyperdulia. So Mary gets her own level of veneration, right?
As she should,
right?
Yes.
Hyperdulia. So that term, dulia, has to do with veneration or praise of a non-latria sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Catholicism claims to be monotheistic, but this can be confusing not only for non-Christians, but for non-Catholic Christians as well, because on the surface it appears to worship saints and angels. That's why it's important to understand these distinctions.
Right.
In the Mass, you will never find anyone but God given the Mass directed to anyone other than God, right? Other than to the triune God, okay? It's always directed, the Mass, the sacrifice of the Mass is always directed to God himself, okay? And that's why it is the supreme action of worship. It's the supreme action of the Catholic cult, right? Even when saints or angels are mentioned, it is always in the context of joining our prayers and merits with theirs in order to offer them to the triune God. So when angels and saints are mentioned in the Mass, we're saying, hey, we want to join our prayers with yours because mm-hmm. you're constantly worshiping God, mm-hmm. right? We want to join our prayers with yours in the worship of God.
Right. You're going to make them better and more effective.
Exactly, right? So for example, in the preface to the Sanctus, right, which is the moment when in Mass when Catholics will chant holy, you know, the Sanctus in Latin, which is holy, holy, holy in English. This is the unending heavenly hymn of praise given to God alone. We always say some variation of the following, right? And actually the priest always says some variation of the following. And so with angels and archangels, with thrones and dominions, and with all the hosts and powers of heaven, we sing the hymn of your glory as without end we acclaim, right? So what are we saying there? And so with angels and archangels, we're joining with them, angels, archangels, thrones and dominions, which are other types of angels, and with all the hosts and powers of heaven, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in heaven, right? All the hosts, all the powers, the entire angelic army, right? We are singing to you, God, right? As without end we acclaim your holiness, right?
Yep.
All right, the way that you're set apart. So that is the Mass is, that's always in the Mass, right? That's always to whom we as Catholics direct our ultimate worship, right? You can also see this in the Te Deum, right? Which is a, you know, traditional Catholic prayer that also has this same view. And it's, you know, it's all over the place in Catholic prayers. So what is dulia? I like to think of dulia as the praise we give to great athletes, right? Like, it's kind of like that. Those who provide a great inspiration to us. So we'll give dulia to us, to saints, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they have moral greatness, right? Because they have gone before us and accomplished great things in the name of Christ,
right?
They've accomplished wonderful things, and we want to learn from them. We want to benefit from their achievements and their accomplishments, and we praise them because that's what feels natural to do.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, and I tell this to people sometimes when I'm talking about, like, talking to non-Catholics about why we do this and why I don't think God's offended by it, right? Because as a father, I love it when my kids praise each other, right? Oh, when they're like, awesome job, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great job,
yeah.
Right? I love it when they come to each other's aid, right? When they work together, when they're, you know, it's like, yes, right? We all know this if you've participated in any kind of like group sport or something like that, mm-hmm. right? You mm-hmm. know the feeling of like, you know, you're not like mad that some, you know, that the coach is never mad that like his team is jiving and giving each other high fives, right?
Right.
Like,
right. Well, that's also a mark of a good coach.
Exactly. It says something about the coach,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that God, that's how he views all of this, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
It's what he wants for us. He wants us to delight in one another,
mm-hmm.
Because ultimately that's going to contribute to his glory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
So when we talk about this veneration, this dulia, you know, there's a couple of different purposes of it. First off is to give praise where praise is due, right?
Mm-hmm.
Second is to ask for the aid, right, of somebody, right? Is to ask for somebody's help. As Christians, I don't know a single Christian who has not ever asked somebody to pray for them,
yeah.
right? And an earthly friend to pray for them, right? And so why shouldn't we ask the saints in heaven? Why shouldn't we ask the angels in heaven to pray for us as well, right? It makes perfect sense because we believe that they're alive in the presence of God.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So we ask for those things. So these are all important distinctions to remember when it comes to this big question of, you know, Tolkien's view of these things, because for him, the Valar are kind of like, they're analogous to the angels of Catholic theology, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you might even think of like, and so with angels and archangels, with thrones and dominions, with Valar and Maiar, and with all the hosts and powers of heaven, we sing the hymn of your glories, that end we acclaim, right?
Yeah, that works.
That would probably make
for
sense
sure.
to Tolkien,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, last thing I want to say is it okay to think of angels as governing the world? And angels, so...
Like with regards to Tolkien, you mean?
Right.
Like would Tolkien have thought that that was okay?
Right.
Okay.
And is this harmonious with his Catholic view of things, right?
Okay.
So, you know, in Middle Earth, the Valar govern the world, as we've established, mm-hmm. right?
And if we're comparing them to angels, that's where this question comes into play, right?
Yeah, and it's a subordinate, right? It's a subordinate mm-hmm. governance. They're not the kings, they're the governors, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're the lords and the governors. And so is that okay in a Catholic view, right? Is it okay to kind of view the angels in that way? And so there's some interesting things that I found, but I'll link to this article, but there's a article from the Catholic Encyclopedia, which is like from the early 20th century. So Tolkien likely would have been familiar with this document. But there's actually a section in here in the article about angels that talks about angels as divine agents governing the world, right?
Hmm.
And it says there, the Semites clearly felt, so the Semites being like the Jews and kind of related peoples, the Semites clearly felt that all the orderly harmony of the universe, as well as the interruptions of that harmony, were due to God as their originator, but were carried out by his ministers,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because God clearly wants to involve his creation in his, like he wants to involve those beings that he has created in his creation. I mean, that's a way to complete his enjoyment of them and of his creation.
Right.
Right. It just brings back that whole notion of the whole like teamwork thing. Mm-hmm. Right. You know?
Well, and it all gets back to this ultimate view of who God is,
mm-hmm.
right? God is infinitely creative. God is infinitely knowing. God is infinitely loving. Right. And the act of creation, of creating this reality that we exist in the Christian view of things, is a it follows from who he is, right?
For sure,
it follows from who he is, and that everything is created as an object of his love,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
To be an object of his love, to receive goodness from him, right? And so you know, we can kind of you know, see how this all plays out. And it's really a wonderful, beautiful view of reality, right?
It is. It absolutely is.
I think
very harmonious.
It's an interesting article anyway. But I'll just say that it's no secret that angels as subordinate governing powers are all over sacred scripture, both Old and New Testaments. As Catholics, we have some feast days for certain angels, including our guardian angels. And yes, we pray to the angels as well as the saints and even offer them praise. There's a famous prayer that we say almost every day called the Saint Michael prayer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we ask Saint Michael to defend us in battle, right? You know, this is all kind of part of what it means to be a Catholic, and that's all part of what Tolkien would have thought as well.
For sure. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Cool beans. Good stuff, dude.
Good. Well, any questions about any of this?
No.
All right.
Well, really good.
Hey, I mean, there's a lot, y'all. So I encourage anybody who's got feedback or got further questions or maybe takes issue, you know, write to us. And this definitely won't be the last time we visit this topic, especially as you guys have more questions and write to us. So I hope that I did, you know, kind of justice in a general sense to those who have different views from myself, and you know, you didn't feel like I was putting down your views necessarily. We might disagree, but I want us to be able to have a dialogue, especially when it comes to the way these things impact Tolkien. So, yeah, I appreciate everybody listening.
Yeah, as do I.
Yeah. All right. Well, like I said at the beginning of the episode, we're going to hold off on our correspondence for Lord of the Rings and Religion until next week. Maybe we'll get a few more notes based on this episode before we record that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll just allow us to do justice to, you know, the great stuff we were, you know, the great feedback we received. I will mention that we have one comment. It's appropriate to read a new iTunes review. And this one, I don't have the name in front of me, unfortunately, but the review is 5 stars and says, "Your Catholic outlook makes this unique. I love how you guys mix deep Tolkien knowledge with his storytelling and his deep Catholicism. It adds a great new dimension to the Tolkien podcast world that isn't often discussed. Tolkien's music is perhaps the best unintentional modern explanation of string theory that we may have. He makes creation understandable on a much deeper and scientific level. Keep up the great work." Did I read that one last week?
I was just thinking that.
The string theory thing gave it away.
Yeah, I think it's...
It came in my inbox again this week, and I was like, I'm just going to keep reading that
That's
one every
so
time.
It's so funny that you asked, because I was like, as you were reading it, I was like, this sounds vaguely familiar, but I'm not going to say anything.
This review is going to become the equivalent of when Paul Rudd goes on Conan O'Brien's show,
right, and shows the
Mac and Me clip.
The Mac and Me clip. This is going to be our Mac and Me clip, this
That's
review.
Right.
Yeah.
Every... For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, just go onto YouTube and Google Conan Paul Rudd, and it'll probably be the first thing that comes up.
Yep.
And every time that Paul Rudd, who, you know, of course, plays Ant-Man, goes on to Conan O'Brien's talk show to promote a new movie or something like that, he always shows the same clip from a kind of cheesy E.T. ripoff from the 1980s.
But
so,
was Paul Rudd even in Mac and Me?
No, he's not.
Right, okay. I was like, I don't think he is. Okay, which makes it even more Conan-ish and funny.
Exactly, yeah. So...
All right.
Well, okay.
How do we end this now? I don't even know.
I need to do a better job of keeping track of what's already been said. All right. Well, we'd love to hear from you guys. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com. Website, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. And thank you to our patrons, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
Lise U.
Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pints with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Matt L.
Johanna T.
Ms. Anonymous.
And Sam N.
Thank you all so much
you
for
guys.
Your support.
Absolutely. Thank
and
you.
And thanks to all of our listeners. We'll talk at you next time.
We will indeed.
Bye-bye.
Bye, y'all.